one day when the women walked to the center of town to visit their wall, the wall was gone. "Have you seen my wall?" asked the woman from the west. "I have not," said the woman from the east. "Have you seen mine?" "No," said the woman from the west. As they approached the spot where the wall used to be, the two women embraced and cried on the shoulder of the other. "I miss my wall," said the woman from the east. "And I miss my wall," said the woman from the west. They wept.
This has been an experiment of time on WRCT Pittsburgh. If you've been digging the music that you have heard tonight, check out the full playlist up on WRCT.org. And that's about it, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great evening. Take care of yourselves.
prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for, harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet, or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community, at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, on September 17th, thousands of handheld pagers exploded simultaneously across Lebanon and Syria. The next day, it was hundreds of walkie-talkies, part of an Israeli attack intended for Hezbollah that Israel's defense minister called the start of a new phase in the war. Media dutifully reported the emerging toll of dead and wounded, including many civilians, including children. Harder to capture is the life-altering impact of such a terror attack on those it doesn't kill. As every day brings news of new carnage, U.S. citizens have a duty not to look away. Given our government's critical role in arming Israel and ignoring its crimes, and in misleading us about what they know and intend. Mohammed Bazzi is director of the Hagop Kevorkian Center for Near Eastern Studies and journalism professor at New York University. He's a former Middle East bureau chief at Newsday. Mohammed Bazzi joins us today to talk about the latest events and media response. That's coming up, but first a look back at some recent press. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel brought criminal charges against students and alumni who participated in a pro-Palestinian protest at the University of Michigan. In an interview with the Detroit Metro Times, Palestinian-American Representative Rashida Tlaib accused Nessel of selective prosecution. Quote, "We've had the right to dissent, the right to protest. We've done it for climate, the immigrant rights movement, for black lives, and even around issues of injustice among water shutoffs. But it seems that the attorney general decided if the issue was Palestine, she was going to treat it differently. And that alone speaks volumes about possible biases within the agency she runs." Close quote. A week later, Nessel, who is Jewish, posted on X, quote, "Rashida should not use my religion to imply I cannot perform my job fairly as attorney general. It's anti-Semitic and wrong." Close quote. Well, that accusation is groundless, as anyone reading Tlaib's actual words can see. But CNN's Jake Tapper, interviewing Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, presented the false accusation as fact and tried to force Whitmer to condemn Tlaib for something she didn't do. After partially quoting the comments, Tapper asked, quote, "Do you think that Tlaib's suggestion that Nessel's office is biased was anti-Semitic?" Close quote. And when Whitmer tried to avoid that bait, he pressed, quote, "Congresswoman Tlaib is suggesting that she shouldn't be prosecuting these individuals that Nessel says broke the law, and that she's only doing it because she's Jewish and the protesters are not. That's quite an accusation. Do you think it's true?" Close quote. Besides being quite untrue, Tapper's charge erases the inconvenient reality that some of the protesters charged are themselves Jewish. But other media took up and repeated Tapper's smear, even after the Metro Times declared it baseless. And Tapper's next move was to bring on Dana Nessel, whom he addressed with this shady semantics. Quote, "What do you make of those today, noting that Congresswoman Tlaib never explicitly said that your bias was because of your religion, and so it's unfair for you to make that allegation?" Close quote. Indeed, Tlaib can hardly have said explicitly something she didn't say at all. But hey, what's reality when you have a lazy, divisive storyline to push? September 28th marks the end of Banned Books Week. The American Library Association reports that attempts to censor books were up 65% in 2023 compared to the previous year, reaching the highest level ever tracked. Almost half of the attacks were aimed at books representing the voices and experiences of LGBTQ+, and Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color. But, as Jesse Hagopian notes in a roundup for Truthout, also under fire in at least one Florida school district, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, which does, you must admit, include some pretty racy words. And finally, the clearest indicator of what elite media see as reasonable is not what ideas they include in the occasional chin-stroking analysis, but those they toss off without comment day to day. Note then the New York Times' David Leonhardt in the paper's popular morning newsletter. Quote, Harris and Trump both have plans to address America's affordable housing shortage. Hers include tax cuts and a benefit for first-time buyers, and his include deportations and lower interest rates. Close quote. Certainly Donald Trump talks about mass deportations, most recently suggesting he could round people up by their serial numbers and pay for it out of the defense budget because, quote, this is an invasion, close quote. To dress that up as a plan for affordable housing is quite a journalistic favor. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Speaking of Israel's remote detonation of thousands of pagers and walkie-talkies of suspected Hezbollah members in Lebanon, former CIA director and defense secretary Leon Panetta told CBS, quote, I don't think there is any question that it's a form of terrorism, close quote. Panetta's remarks were widely reported, mostly straight, but for Fox, where Sean Hannity said Panetta had the gall to say Israel is engaging terrorism against the terror group Hezbollah. It seems worth noting, just before Panetta, CBS viewers heard from a former FBI analyst who said of the explosions in stores, cars, and homes that killed some 39 people and injured more than 3,000, including children, quote, tactically, what Israel has done has been brilliant. They have severely degraded Hezbollah's capabilities. They've severely degraded Hezbollah's ability to respond to Israeli things. They're really hoping that, strategically, Hezbollah gets the message, stop firing rockets into our country, close quote. That tactic has led to more death, more destruction, and some say more chance of a still wider, more devastating war. Joining us now to talk about unfolding events and U.S. media's depictions is Mohammed Bazzi. He's director of the Hagop Kevorkian Center for Near Eastern Studies and journalism professor at New York University, as well as former Middle East bureau chief at Newsday. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome to Counterspin, Mohammed Bazzi.
Thank you for having me.
Well, CBS segued from the brilliant tactic guy to Leon Panetta by saying that some saw Israel's action, quote, as a deception one step too far. The United Nations labeled the operation a violation of international law, and it's raised some eyebrows here at home, too, close quote. It's equally hard to imagine that this wasn't a violation as that it wouldn't immediately be condemned as such had anyone else carried it out, would you say?
That's an excellent point. It would certainly have been condemned, let's say, if Russia had carried out a similar operation or even something, a fraction of this kind of attack in Ukraine. I think one of the things that struck me, and I suspect it struck you and others who watch the Western media, is the sense of marvel over the ingenuity of Israel's technological prowess. So what we had is a lot of the coverage framed as, oh, oh, this is taking a page out of a spy thriller or a dystopian movie. And in some ways, what unfolded in Lebanon last week was something dystopian, but it wasn't a movie. It affected real people's lives. And so many in the Western media were fixating on the novelty of Israel's attack and sometimes celebrating it, but they neglected to acknowledge this is a society that suffered through years and years of trauma. And this was the latest attack that, you know, unfolded in this incredibly pernicious way. A lot of the coverage also didn't get into the question of whether this constituted a war crime. And on the face of it, it seems to meet the definition of a war crime. Human Rights Watch, a few other rights organizations issued statements noting that international humanitarian law forbids the use of booby traps, especially with objects that have such important use for civilians. I think it would fit the definition of a war crime beyond just being an act of terrorism that's meant to instill terror in a civilian population.
Well, Hezbollah, like Hamas, is for many U.S. media consumers almost like a sports team, you know, or like a kaiju, you know, a monster like Godzilla, you know. And I think it might sound strange to some to think that they aren't solely a military force in Lebanon, but in fact have a much broader role.
Yeah, a lot of media consumers and listeners in the U.S. don't get the context. They don't get the background that Hezbollah is not only a militia. It is not only the militia that's labeled a terrorist group by the U.S. and by many countries in the EU, but it's also the most dominant military force in Lebanon, and it's also the most powerful political party and political movement in the country. So Hezbollah runs an extensive social service network. It operates schools and hospitals and supermarkets and credit unions. One of the things that became clear fairly quickly after the first wave of pager explosions on Tuesday, Hezbollah issued a statement after that wave of explosions saying that it had issued pagers to employees of various units and institutions, meaning they had distributed the devices not only to fighters, but to many civilian workers. That was one reason there were so many civilian casualties in this attack, but there are other reasons as well. And it's the act of terror, it's the imprecise nature, this deliberate setting off of detonations of thousands of small bombs that went off at the same time in the afternoon, on a Tuesday afternoon, as people were going about their daily lives. And so the bombs went off in grocery stores and hospitals and sidewalk cafes and barbershops. The next day on Wednesday, some of the walkie-talkie explosions went off during the funerals of people who had been killed the day before during the pager explosions. So this was an entirely indiscriminate attack. And it puts the Western media fascination with Israel's technological prowess into even sharper focus. We had the Western press marveling at, I'll just quote a few of the terms, Israeli prowess, precision, James Bond type operation, and quite a few other terms that obscured the sheer terror of what Israel had carried out over those 2 days in Lebanon.
Well, listeners will know that Hezbollah and Israel have been exchanging airstrikes since October 8th, and this recent escalation comes as Israel continues to target schools and shelters housing the displaced in Gaza. And Gaza is still, you say, the key here to any potential de-escalation. Even as eyes may move towards Lebanon, Gaza is still at the core here.
Yeah, Gaza is certainly at the core here. And this is the lesson that Biden administration is refusing to internalize. It's the most obvious path to de-escalation throughout the region, which is to pressure Israel to accept a ceasefire. There's been a ceasefire deal on the table for months now that Benjamin Netanyahu keeps finding reasons to obstruct and keeps adding new conditions. And why shouldn't he? If He's not facing any real pressure from the U.S. He's not facing pressure from the Biden administration, which refuses to use the real leverage it has over Israel. And that leverage is in the form of billions of dollars in U.S. weapons that continue to flow to Israel on a daily basis. So Joe Biden has decided that he's not going to use the best leverage he has at his disposal to pressure Netanyahu into a ceasefire. And instead, he's going to kind of do this, you know, very wishy-washy leaks in the press where Biden administration aides keep leaking how disappointed Biden has been, at how angry he is at Netanyahu. There was a leak a few months ago that Biden privately called Netanyahu an asshole at least three times. I think that was ABC News that reported that several months ago. And it's just, it's obscene, this level of trying to manage the story in this way, trying to get across the idea that the U.S., which has the upper hand in this situation, is somehow helpless to pressure Netanyahu into a ceasefire. All of the Iranian allied groups in the region, starting with Hezbollah and the Houthis in Yemen, have made clear that they would stop their attacks if and when the war in Gaza ends. So once there's a ceasefire, once the fighting stops in Gaza, they too would stop. And I'll remind your listeners that during the last ceasefire, the 7-day ceasefire at the end of November, when there was an exchange of hostages for Palestinian prisoners, Hezbollah and the Houthis and other Iranian allied groups in the region did stop their attacks. So I think there's evidence that they would stick to this promise.
And as you've sort of indicated, for the corporate press, it seems the role of the U.S. in the Mideast generally has ranged from honest broker, which used to be a term we'd hear a lot, to now it's kind of conflicted do-gooder. It does seem, though, that every day more and more people are seeing through that depiction, even though, as you would say, some people are clinging to it desperately. There is a more clear-eyed understanding of the U.S. role peeping through around the edges of that storyline, don't you think?
I hope so. And I think the evidence of that is the majority of people in the U.S. that have been telling public opinion polls that they oppose the indefinite arming of Israel in this war and enabling Israel to carry out the huge destruction, the famine, war crimes, everything it has done in Gaza over the past 11 months, and that it's now importing the same strategy into Lebanon. There's growing public opposition in the U.S. to this untethered support for Israel, this unconditional support that Biden has promised since October 8th. And I think that's partly because people are consuming information from social media, from other sources beyond the legacy media, beyond the corporate media, isn't showing anywhere near the level of destruction that's happening in Gaza, and that isn't framing the story, as you put it. It's framing the stories of the U.S. as an honest broker or a do-gooder that's simply run out of options and that's thrown its hands up in desperation and just waiting for Netanyahu to accept the ceasefire. That's not the kind of leverage that the U.S. has, and it's nowhere near the role that the U.S. has in all of this. The Biden administration is heavily complicit. And when we see in the years and decades to come, hopefully when we see some form of accountability in international bodies, it's fairly easy to expect the U.S. to go up before the International Court of Justice or U.S. officials to be indicted before the ICC and other bodies, even though we're not a party to the ICC, mm-hmm. to face these kinds of prosecutions for their role in arming Israel, despite the overwhelming evidence of what the Israeli military has been doing in Gaza and now in Lebanon.
Well, I have to ask you, as a journalism professor and journalist, your thoughts about free speech and assembly, not just Israel's direct targeting of journalists, the recent raid and shutdown of Al Jazeera in the occupied West Bank, the unaccountable killing of activist Aishnor Ezgi-Egi, but also Cornell University moving to deport a graduate student who took part in a pro-Palestinian protest. It all feels like an attack on witnessing, on knowing what's going on and what's being done in our name.
Right. There's a widespread attack on the act of bearing witness to what's being done. There's a widespread attack on the ability of people of conscience to protest and to disagree with the policies of their governments, especially the policy of the U.S. government to support Israel in this unconditional way. And it's a sign of the bravery of students, certainly, that have been operating and protesting at campuses across the country, at private universities, at public universities. It's a sign of their moral commitment to this cause, that they've persevered despite these threats, despite being suspended, despite some of them, as in Cornell, now facing deportation because that graduate student could well lose his U.S. visa and would have to leave the country because of his political actions supporting Palestine and Gaza. And so we're seeing average people taking tremendous risks to be able to express themselves and to say, no, not in my name. I'm not going to accept my government and my institutions supporting this. And I hope that that's the start of the turning point here. And I think it's one of the things that's contributing to the change in public opinion, where public opinion is turning against the idea of the U.S. arming Israel and supporting Israel indefinitely.
Well, there are calls now for Secretary of State Antony Blinken to resign after it's been reported, I believe by ProPublica, that he was in receipt of assessments from both USAID and the State Department's Refugees Bureau that Israel had blocked deliveries of humanitarian aid to Gaza. He had that information, Blinken did, when he went before Congress and said there was no evidence of that. Short even of his resignation, though, how many times do U.S. officials need to lie or hide or dissimulate before journalists stop quoting them credulously? You know, isn't it just insulting to readers and to the public at some point?
We certainly have many decades of this,
right?
Going back to Vietnam,
of course.
Before Vietnam, of U.S. officials lying about war and lying about U.S. support for allies who commit atrocities. The report from ProPublica has been an exception. It's an excellent report. It just came out in the last couple of days based on internal leaks, because there are officials in the State Department and elsewhere in the Biden administration that find all of this unconscionable and don't want to see this continued support. And it's a very important leak, not just because of what it tells us about Blinken and others in the administration and their ability and willingness to lie to the U.S. public and to lie to the U.S. media, but also shows us that there's actually a fairly straightforward path for the Biden administration to stop its weapons transfers to Israel, because those weapons transfers violate U.S. laws. And if they were honest and if they had admitted it, they would have had to stop sending weapons, because that's what U.S. law requires. It's what the Biden administration's own guidelines require. So that was a tremendously important leak by ProPublica. And unfortunately, I've seen some references to it in the past few days, but it's not getting the widespread attention in the corporate media and in the legacy media that it should be getting. It's certainly getting a lot of attention on social media. People are sharing it and sharing the documents, and it's creating these calls for Blinken to resign or for Biden to do something. But it's certainly troubling to see the legacy media ignore this as well. And it all raises the question of, what more do you want? What more can be presented to the media for it to change its approach to covering this war?
In addition to the appropriate engagement of that piece of information from that leak, Are there any other things that you would like to see more of in U.S. media coverage, or things you'd like to never see again in that coverage?
I would certainly like to see more humane coverage. Mm-hmm. It's a basic ask, and it's unfortunate that we have to make this ask, but I would like to see more humane coverage of Palestinians, of Lebanese, of other Arabs and Muslims. I think one of the things we've seen just in this past week, in the way that the pager explosions and the walkie-talkie explosions were covered, this marveling over Israel's ingenuity, it ignores the reality on the ground, but it also contributes to the dehumanization of Palestinians and Lebanese and Arabs, this widespread dehumanization that we've seen certainly for decades, but we've seen it ramp up to an extreme since Israel launched its war on Gaza. So it's a basic ask, but I would like to see some greater humanization and friends covering those attacks as would cover other attacks on civilians. It's not too much to ask for.
We've been speaking with Mohammed Bazzi, director of the Hagop Kevorkian Center for Near Eastern Studies and journalism professor at New York University. His piece, Israel's Growing War with Hezbollah is Traumatizing Lebanon, There's Only One Path to Peace, appeared in the September 23rd Los Angeles Times. Mohammed Bazzi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find years of shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The website is also the place to learn about our newsletter called Extra, and it's the place to show much-needed support for the show, if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
What if the second deadliest cancer in men and women could be prevented? Would you try to avoid the pain? And what if you could protect yourself without leaving your home? Colorectal cancer is highly preventable. Screening is important, safe, and most people have options. Ask your doctor which screening test is right for you. Learn more from the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at getscreened.org.
Well, Russell, what is philosophy?
Well, that's a very controversial question. I think no two philosophers will give you the same answer. My own view would be that philosophy consists of speculations about matters where exact knowledge is not yet possible. But that would only be my answer, not anybody else's.
We'll be right back. You've tuned in to Audible Sounds on 88.3 WRCT, Pittsburgh. And today on the show, we've got some early experimental electronic music for you. So if you're not sure why this show is called Audible Sounds, you're about to find out why. But first, who is that opening track? Why, it was the artist Habibi, with the opening track off of her album, Dream Machine. And like I said, things are about to get noisy on this station. Not to worry, though. We'll ease you into it. For our next track, though, here's the artist Lalome with the tracks La Tijera and El Cran. I hope you enjoy. Records spin, so do carousels. Tune into our joint rotating show every Monday at 6 p.m. and step away from your keyboard into Loja do Mestre Andre and hear potentially anything. Brought to you by Lyra Mestre Andre and Colette. And round and around we go.
comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You're listening to Audible Sounds, and what you're hearing now is the work of Bernard Parmigiani, a pioneer of the genre known as music concrete. From 1967, this is Capture Epimere, and it can be found on the album Complete Works, Volume 1. I'll see you in 10 minutes. The Ellie Show. On Sundays, wake up to The Ellie Show on WRCT for top-tier interviews, awesome music, and good vibes only. The Ellie Show is what cool people listen to on Sundays at 12 p.m. on 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh and online at WRCT.org.
I do not want life to be taken seriously. Seriousness is a kind of psychological disease. Life has to be a fun. Life has to be a rejoicing, a dance, a song, a love affair. In such a small life, being serious is simply wasting the opportunity.
Oh,
everyday, vulgar, commonsensical notion of freedom. The idea that the human individual can sometimes act as a spontaneous, uncaused cause. This, he says, is impossible. It's simply an illusion that's engendered by our not knowing what the causes of our actions are. But on the other hand, there is such a thing as human servitude or bondage. And that consists in being induced to act by some causes rather than others. There are some causes, the passive emotions, things like hatred and anger and so forth, generated in us by the frustrating influence of the world outside us. And he also believes that we have active emotions, which are those generated by an understanding of our circumstances in the world, a knowledge of what's going on. And the greater our activities are caused by active emotions and the less by passive emotions.
WRCT is supported by Spack Brothers Pizza, located at 5107 Penn Avenue in Bloomfield. Spack Brothers Pizza offers pizza, hoagies, and wings, and salads, while specializing in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. Spack Brothers Pizza uses no refined sugar in its sauce and unbleached flour in its dough. Spack Brothers offers both takeout and delivery. For more information, email them at SpackHelp@gmail.com or visit their website at SpackBrothers.com. If you are interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email PR@WRCT.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. And that was Leah Bartusi off of her album Extended Vox with the track We Do Wish We Were With You, Part 2, featuring Audrey Chen and Phil Minton. For our next track, we've got another duo for you, with Cecilia Lopez and Ingrid Laubrook, with the track Cuerda Floja, or Tightrope, off of the album Maromas.